This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we have a special one-hour program on the war crime that the Israeli government, with American complicity, has been conducting against 1.5 million people of the Gaza Strip.
It didn't just start with the bombing that we're hearing about now. The blockade of Gaza has been called a humanitarian disaster, a violation of fundamental human rights. It didn't even start with that. Some of our guests will take you back to 1948 and before. Stay with us. Last week, Israel launched what has been described as one of the bloodiest attacks on Palestinians in Gaza since 1948. Protesters demonstrated worldwide as Israeli airstrikes continued. As we speak to you, nearly 400 Palestinians have been killed and thousands injured from the bombing campaign. Targets have included a Hamas building, an Islamic university, a police station, parts of a refugee camp, and other civilian targets. Gaza is approximately 146 square miles with one of the densest populations in the world of 1.5 million people, over half of whom are refugees. Today we're joined by two experts on Gaza and Israel. One is Joel Covell, the author of Overcoming Zionism, Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel. The other is an American lawyer, Audrey Bomsey, who has been living for 7 years in East Jerusalem, and was one of the people on the second boat that broke the blockade into Gaza. So we're pleased today to have both Joel and Audrey.
Joel, here we are with you on a terrible, really a terrible time. And you're the author of the book Overcoming Zionism. And, you know, we're talking to you right now at the beginning of a new Israeli assault on Gaza.
Right.
And so we'd like some perspective on you. What's going on? What do you think's going to happen?
Sure. Well, first of all, for the benefit of the listeners, I would just comment that there's been an invasion for 110 years, and people have to see it that way. And they're mystified because of the power of the propaganda system and the way in which the Israeli state is normalized and made to seem an ordinary, you know, government that is a member of the, you know, community of nations, so to speak, to overlook that fact that no matter at what point you study the history of the phenomenon of Zionism, which of course eventuates in an Israeli state but predates it 50-odd years, no matter at what point you study it, there is a basic underlying logic which is to remove everything that is non-Jewish from the historic Palestine. You can map that, you know, you can see their peaks and valleys and times of relative agreeability and times of maximum terror. And now is one of the latter times, and that terror might get even more maximum. But the terror part of it is an iron condition for that. The Zionist logic is one in which the settlers were not, you know, not armed at first, and they had to use various kinds of devious means and indeed rely upon foreign powers, which is something that took place from the very beginning when Herzl goes around to Germany and Ottoman Turkey and gets nowheres until finally the Balfour Declaration comes along, and then you have a genuine kind of patron amongst the great powers. And now, of course, they have the mega patron amongst the great powers, our own United States, which plays a fantastically important role. But the terror strategy is one that belongs to the Zionist project itself, and particularly when it acquires a state. I mean, after the Peel Commission met in 1937, when there had been a great Arab uprising and it was being put down very brutally, the commission recommended that the country be partitioned and that the Jewish Zionists get a state and the Arab, you know, Muslims get a state. There was consternation in the Jewish Zionist camp at that point because they wanted the whole thing. They didn't want it partitioned. And Ben-Gurion, who was, you know, the sort of the George Washington of this movement, said, listen, don't worry. What we need to get a state. And even if the state is only on part of the land, don't worry. Once we get a state, the state itself will continue the process. So he was smart enough to see that the state was just a phase, and that was 48 and 47 and 48. And that state really hit the ground running in that direction, and Ilan Papi's great book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, and many others, although I think Papi's book is the definitive one, makes it clear that there's a huge continuity of this project. And if we had a lot of time, we could detail all the landmarks. But the key point is that the state that is set up, which is, according to Zionist logic, has to be a Jewish state for and by the Jews, and that is to say of, for, and by the Zionist project to get rid of everything non-Jewish, necessarily also becomes a terror state. You know, there are times when it's relatively peaceable, but I think over the course of time, and particularly as it becomes hooked up with integral part of U.S. imperialism in the Middle East, the terroristic aspects of the Israeli state become increasingly pronounced.
I'm looking at what you're saying in terms of the sweep of Zionist history, right, which I understand, and fitting Gaza into that.
Yeah.
So I'd like you to also bring us up to the present and how you see what's going on in Gaza right now as the immediate causes are and what, of course, the long term. You've just sort of put it in that context.
But I just want to give that perspective, because unless you see it as a long-range project, you're going to be lost in, you know, well, let's have a ceasefire, maybe that will help, or let's let the sides get together, or, you know, the Israelis and the Palestinians have to negotiate. You can't conceive that the Israelis would negotiate in good faith once you realize how deeply embedded is this drive to eliminate everything non-Jewish from the land of Palestine. You know, this project necessarily gets into all kinds of troubles and contradictions. And one of them, of course, is that eventually you have a concentration of 1.5 million people in this very small part of southwestern Israel. And about half of them are actual refugees in camps. And these people are themselves enormously difficult for the Zionists to deal with. This is speculative on my part. In my point, they really don't know what to do with them. They would love to drive them into the sea, but there's certain constraints. They can't do everything. So what they do is they just temporize and build a prison for them. At the same time, they go through the charade that we're going to have like a normal political process. And lo and behold, there was such a process to some degree. And, you know, the Hamas wins a legitimate election. You have a democratically elected government which was elected because it was militant, not because it was Islamist or, you know, terrorist itself, but just because it was militant. It would not go along. It would refuse and reject. This then means that this 1.5 million people in this camp are now led by a group that can't be bought off, that can't be, you know, co-opted and compromised. And then U.S. policy and Israeli policy run out of the National Security Council by Elliot Abrams is to set the Hamas and the Fatah, you know, the Quisling people who basically go along with this long-term strategy of the Zionists against each other. And that doesn't work. Hamas whips Fatah, takes complete control over that part of the world. And at that point, I mean, there's a kind of an inevitability. It's like a huge splinter, you know. You have a splinter under your skin and you feel that this is your organism. You've got to get that splinter out. And I think that there's this endless, you know, rage building up amongst the Israelis to eliminate the Gaza problem entirely. And of course, they know they can't, but it doesn't mean they don't feel that way. Like if you have a splinter, you got to get rid of it. Now, I mean, the key thing is, of course, that there are temporary present mediations, like upcoming elections on the part of Israel, and which will be due in February. And we have three major candidates, two of whom are standing as part of the ruling Kadima party, one of whom is standing as the party to their right, namely Likud, Netanyahu. And in a typical electoral ploy, which we see over and over again, just like we saw in the United States with the Iraq War, you know, you play the patriotism card, you play the we're being attacked card, which is also part of the basic logic of Zionism. It has to see itself as a perpetual victim, even as it's stamping out and crushing and bombing and doing everything. It's always being victimized. But I think you see the two sides, or three candidates, actually vying to see who could be the worst with respect to this splinter under the skin and soul of Israel. And so it is that this present attack follows a very pathetically administered, but nonetheless honestly administered on the part of Hamas ceasefire that was brokered by Egypt. And now you have to also factor in Egypt and the other, you know, local governments that are completely under the thumb of the United States, by and large, with the exception, of course, of Syria. This ending of the ceasefire with the increasing, you know, closeness to the election, I think leads the ruling powers in the Kadima party to plan this terror attack. And they have to, of course, all they need is a provocation. You know, it's like they go into Lebanon 2 years ago and, you know, one Israeli soldier is captured. They say kidnapped, which is nonsense. Next thing you know, all the bombers go. It doesn't take anything but a look the wrong way to trigger this kind of intense destructive mechanism, which is built into the heart of the Israeli state. One last point. There's another player here, which is our president-elect, Obama. And I think they also are trying to pin him down and make it constrain him even further. Now, he has behaved utterly disgracefully up to this point. And yet there always is the question mark, well, maybe he's, you know, keeping his cards close to the vest, and he's going to play a, you know, a principled card once he becomes president. And they're making it harder and harder for him to do that, because they basically want to give it the old fact on the ground, so that when Obama becomes president, he has to continue selling out and betraying his principles, as he has done, as I said, in a very disgraceful way. I think the immediate triggering of this is the exigencies of the current election. It's standard political shenanigans of playing the, you know, the patriotism card, that we're, you know, the old Goering thing. You just make the people feel they're being attacked and they can go wild and they'll always go to war for you. And I think that's the immediate trigger point. But it's really important to bear in mind that this has worked. And the reason it's worked is that there is this huge sentiment within the Israeli population, because of the way the Zionism has, you know, gotten deeply under the skin of everybody, as well as the Palestinians, that they really do hate the Palestinians. There is enormous anti-Palestinian racism amongst Israel. There is just rage, and it doesn't take anything to bring forth a really shocking degree of nihilism and the desire to annihilate the Palestinians, and that's what's really very scary.
I want to bring Audrey into this conversation. You've been listening to Joel, plus you're just back from Israel, and you tried yourself to go into the Gaza. But first, I guess, some thoughts about the recent incursion into Gaza and listening to Joel, and then we'll go back with you a little bit, Audrey.
The recent bombings, as atrocious as they are just the latest of a whole series of abuses that Israel has perpetrated on Gaza. Since the Hamas election in August in 2007, there's been a closure which gets continually tighter. That's when, first of all, when Hamas took over, with the support of the quartet, that's not only the United States, but the UN, the EU, and Russia, they have started cutting off travel in and out of Gaza and cutting down the supply of basic necessities into Gaza, getting tighter and tighter. And this kind of abuse was permitted by the world community. Recently, before the bombings, there was a series of statements by normally cautious UN and other international experts concerning Israel. I mean, the Secretary General of the UN, the President of the General Assembly, have come out all with statements condemning what was going on as collective punishment. Richard Falk, the Special Rapporteur on human rights in the occupied Palestinian territories, called what was going on a crime against humanity and asked for there to be an investigation on the part of the International Criminal Court of possible violations by both Israeli military and civilian people of crimes against humanity. I see the ceasefire as not ending in December, but has having ended really in November, in early November, when Israel provoked a Hamas reaction. I agree with what Joel said, that Israel has a pattern of provoking the Palestinian resistance and then can claim that it's the victim. So I think it was November 6th of this year, Israel said that they discovered tunnels under Gaza, going into or near military bases, invaded Gaza. This was while the ceasefire was in effect, killed six Hamas militants, and in reaction to that, there was a flurry of rockets that Hamas sent into Israel. That was essentially the end of the ceasefire. Israel then cut off all access into Gaza, including humanitarian aid, cut off access to journalists, to UN personnel. And then came the stated end of the ceasefire, I think it was December 19th, and more rockets came from Gaza. But Israel was able to portray itself as the victim for this series of rockets that was sent over. And I'm not justifying rockets into civilian areas, but it's kind of the inevitable consequence of a set of circumstances that Israel has placed the Gazans in, where they can... they have to either accept those circumstances or resist in any way they can, and they do. And then Israel uses that as a provocation to escalate, which they're doing now. So it's just the latest, the most dramatic of a series of escalations and provocations on the part of Israel, and the series of violations of human rights, which Israel has been able to get away with.
Audrey, you're recently back in the United States. I remember the last time I saw you was about 5-6 years ago at a National Lawyers Guild convention. And you were at that time here temporarily going back to the West Bank. You were working for an NGO at the time. Most recently, you've been involved in the Gaza boat lift. I wanted to ask you, what was that like?
I was involved in the second trip from the Free Gaza Movement. The trip itself was incredible. You saw the total devastation of Gaza.
And you were bringing medical supplies on a boat across the Mediterranean.
Yeah, we brought in 5 tons of medical supplies. We brought in doctors, largely Palestinian doctors living in the diaspora, in the European diaspora, and some human rights people, myself as a lawyer, Mairead Maguire, the Nobel Peace Prize winner from Ireland. We got in and we saw the people there are living in a humanitarian catastrophe. They've been reduced to the point of having to worry about where their food. Are they going to have food for the family tomorrow? Is there going to be electricity in the house? I was invited to friends for dinner, friends I'd been working with for years, to the family house, and they had to order out because there was no cooking gas left. People came to the boat when the boat left and asked if they could give us money so we would bring in back powdered milk for their children. There's not milk available there. There's just enough being let in through the crossings to prevent massive starvation and widespread disease. But I want to emphasize that this is a man-made catastrophe. I mean, it's the consequence of a political policy on the part of Israel. So it's really not so much a humanitarian crisis as a human rights crisis.
The key word that I think in all of this is impunity. Israel has impunity. It can get away with murder. And because it can get away with murder, it murders and then demands more impunity because it's committing crimes on a wider and wider scale, you know? I had to not read the New York Times yesterday because it was just too bad for my health to read the New York Times, to read that kind of saccharine hypocrisy that, Hamas has to play fair and Hamas is always foregrounded as the bad guy. I mean, the mainstream press will constantly frame this in such a way that the claims of Zionist Israel are considered, you know, paramount. And beneath that is this enormous manipulated, stirred up well of Holocaust sentiment. You know, every month, another Holocaust movie comes out, you know, and it always the lesson is the Jews are facing extermination and therefore they have to strike first or, you know, the never again philosophy. And so, you know, it's not just the press, but it's the media, you know, it's Hollywood. And if you teach in universities and you try to introduce a serious critical line against Israel, much less an anti-Zionist line, your career is in major doubt. And so it goes. You know, Richard Falk is kicked out of Israel for simply bearing witness. You know, they cannot have that kind of witness bared, because if it took hold, the whole project would go down like a house of cards. We have to realize that our political input, aside from direct humanitarian and acts of solidarity with Gaza, which is what we're hearing from Audrey, but also, I mean, you know, supplies, medical supplies that they need, I think as important, in the long run, even more important, is to break down the structures in this society that grant Israel its fatal and deadly impunity, and fatal and deadly to itself, too, I may add.
On Richard Falk, to show the level of impunity, it's not just to that Israel is permitted, gets away with the bombings of Gaza and Lebanon before, but I mean, Richard Falk was not just expelled from Israel, he was kept in detention for 20 hours. And imagine, he came
so
in as I was too, but he came in as the UN special rapporteur.
Right.
And rather than letting him know beforehand, because he said if he had known beforehand that he wouldn't be allowed in, he wouldn't come in. But they created this incident and are allowed to get away with it. Look what happened with the last trip of the Free Gaza boat. It was rammed with Cynthia McKinney. There were three doctors, surgeons going over, and they were going to stay in because there's a medical system in Gaza. And I was totally overburdened. The ICU, there's not enough space. They're turning away people. So there was the boat was going in with medical supplies, with medical personnel, with Cynthia McKinney and other observers. And in the international waters, 90 miles away from Gaza, they were surrounded by Israeli warships and were rammed to the point where there was so much damage that they couldn't even get back to Cyprus. They had to pull into Lebanon. It's in international waters, and you know Israel feels that nothing will happen to it.
Let me ask you another legal question, and I'll ask this of you too, Michael. When Israel unleashed its bombing, from what I've read, it took them 3 minutes and 54 seconds, and they left 280 people dead just from that initial blast, plus hundreds and hundreds of people injured. Does this violate any aspect of international law, and which?
The law of war stipulates, first of all, that there not be collective punishment, that the entire civilian population not be subjected to punishment because of the acts of a small group of people, and that it prohibits targeting civilian population disproportionate to military necessity. What was the military necessity?
I look at this a lot in terms of the so-called war on Al-Qaeda and what you can do.
Yes, right.
And, you know, you have all these policemen in Gaza who have jobs working for Gaza, for Hamas in Gaza, but to keep the civilian population like all cops. And they purposely and intentionally bombed and killed, I don't know how many dozens of policemen. That's completely illegal. I mean, you can't, even assuming you would consider Hamas, as the U.S. does, a terrorist organization, and you may be able to, you know, go after a soldier who's at the top of Hamas, who's a military guy. That's one thing in some, assuming you accept all the assumptions of the U.S. But you can't just go after people who work in the government for Hamas.
The Ministry of Interior.
Yeah, you can't do that.
Or
I mean,
the university.
And the TV station, of course.
The
but these policemen who somehow, how do they connect those policemen with anything that they could target? I mean, complete, utter violation of the fundamental parts of international law.
Real quick, that's right. And I remember when the story first broke, I forget which news outlet I was reading. I think it was the New York Times, but I'm not certain. But it was saying, well, Israel attacked and they hit Hamas militants, namely policemen.
I couldn't believe it. I read the same story, Joel. That's what struck me.
It's like, what?
And the thing is, they're not counted as combatants.
Right.
Because
combatants.
The figures are 370 people killed and only 56 non-combatants.
Right.
Well, who are these others?
All of a sudden, these policemen are
really
combatants.
Let me play devil's advocate for a second. Let me just put in a word, say, from the Israeli point of view, in defense of collective punishment. Hamas is a terrorist organization. The only way we're going to pressure the Palestinian people on the Gaza Strip to get rid of this government is to cause death and hardship to them, and that's why we're going to do it. And we're doing this ultimately in self-defense, and that's why we think collective punishment is justified. What's wrong with that argument?
Well, first of all, it's illegal.
Right. We all know that that's exactly, you know, after
that
one
is the essence
after one German soldier is killed in an Italian village, they take the other 300 people in the Italian village, line them up and kill them.
Yeah.
And that's collective punishment, and that is a basic underlying backbone of international law. You can't do it.
And also,
so that's the same with tearing down houses. That's this whole business.
And also, you know, Hobbes.
And the reason for that is that the basic principle of international law is not to harm civilians. And this is aimed at harming civilians. It doesn't work either.
Well, that's the other thing that's interesting here. Yeah. They thought that when they went into Lebanon, right?
Yeah, sure.
And what'd they do? Make heroes out of Hezbollah to the extent they weren't already. Yeah. It's not like this works. And as Joel, you pointed out, Fatah was considered totally bankrupt in terms of standing up for Palestinian rights. So Hamas actually, you know, because they were willing to...
They had backbone.
Yeah.
Hobbes, the great, quite conservative British political philosopher, said, you know, in a society, power consists of the capacity to give names and enforce definitions. One step further back, which is, they're called a terrorist. By who? You know, I mean, what, you know, just like I'm called anti-Semitic, you know, by who?
I mean, just think about the fact is the Hamas rockets, assuming they were even Hamas rockets, supposedly killed, what, a dozen, 15 Israelis? Yeah. Oh, in fact, including an Israeli-Palestinian.
There hasn't been any until the bombing started.
Right.
In 10 years, I think it's like a dozen. Whereas in 2 days, 400 people. So the question is, ask yourself, who's the terrorist?
Yeah.
Who is the terrorist? I remember Chomsky and Herman had this book about retail versus wholesale.
Right, right. Yeah, and
retail terrorism is knocking off one or two.
And people
is knocking off the hundreds.
And people should republish Ed Herman's great book, The Real Terror Network, because, I mean, there's no question that states are the primary instruments of terror. If by terror, and let's define it. This is not a power definition. It's just logical. Terror is the use of fear and for political purposes on populations, right? So who does it? The states that do that. And the Israeli state is by any definition, a terrorist state. But, of course, Hamas is labeled terrorist. And you see this. People get up in the newscasters say, well, Hamas, by the U.S. State Department says Hamas is a terrorist organization. Therefore, Israel is justified in what they're doing. And then the whole argument sort of disappears from the collective screen of humanity.
What's amazing is Israel has declared all-out war against Hamas. I mean, Israel is... What is it? It's one of the top military powers in the world with the most sophisticated military equipment. They're
Thanks
going
the
up
US.
Against Hamas, which does has have several security forces, but there's no army, the real army. There's no navy. There's no air force. Who are they fighting
it's
in this all-out war against?
There's no tanks. There's nothing. You see those Israeli tanks come through.
They're fighting with homemade bombs and a few more sophisticated weapons. Now they've been able to smuggle through some tunnels from Egypt, but this is not an army. Yeah.
Let me ask you a question about what Joel referred to as impunity in the lock here. And I'm looking now at various organizations in the United States, human rights organizations in particular, but really more broadly. And the issue here for any human rights organization is how do you take on Israel-Palestine without essentially losing your funding? That's really what it comes down to. And I see it all the time. I see it with organizations that say we want to do domestic work on as Jewish people and help Katrina victims and help this, but we can't take on Israel because we'll lose all our money.
Exactly.
And unless that can be broken, my view is that has to be broken. I don't have a way to do it quickly, but it's just that my feeling is you've got to be able to push these organizations and say you have to take a human rights stand. Otherwise, you're being an ostrich.
Right.
It's like living in Germany and saying have a food line, but while the Holocaust is going on behind you.
Right.
So
yeah.
The question is, I'm just interested in both your thoughts on how you think about that.
Part of it is the definition of what human rights perspective is, that the Western human rights NGOs, such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and the others, do take a stand. I'm sure they are coming out condemning what's going on now.
They got heavily criticized when they did the cluster bomb report on Lebanon. The City Sun, which happily no longer exists.
They will continue
or whatever it was,
to
not
do
the City
that.
Sun, this whatever that paper, the Sun was.
Right. Sun, yeah.
Yeah, they went after Ken Roth completely on that, but they had a video on Lebanon, and they did that. That's right.
However, none of them condemn the occupation. They will come out
that's
and condemn
true.
Symptoms of the of the occupation, not only the bombings, assassinations, settlements, Israeli settlements, all kinds of individual or even collection of symptoms. Yeah. But none of them will deal with the root cause of the problem.
Yeah. There's a hierarchy because there's the symptoms and then there's the occupation. But is the occupation the root cause? No. Because the occupation was, again, part of the logic of Zionist Israel.
And it depends what your definition of the occupation is.
Well, but, but Tanya Reinhardt, a wonderful woman, sadly deceased, wrote this fascinating, important book. You know, I forget it was about 1948. 1948 is a more crucial year than 1967.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Professor Joel Covell, author of Overcoming Zionism, and attorney Audrey Bomsey, just back from the Gaza Strip and before that the West Bank, and hopefully she can get back in, but the Israelis have said no, kept her in detention for several days, and they sent her back to the United States. And we're speaking about the shock and awe of the Israelis in Gaza and what we can do about it.
Usually, you know, the analysis stops in 1967, if we only could deal with the occupation or if we could only have a sound two-state solution. But wait a second, a two-state solution would preserve Israel in Zionist form. Even now, Israeli politicians like Lipni are saying, well, if we have two states, that's great. We'll use it as an opportunity to transfer out the Palestinians from Israel, the Arabs from Israel. 20% of the population, they're talking about using the two-state to get rid of them.
And yeah, I thought we were amazed by that statement.
Yeah, it's amazing.
That was a real shocker.
But the point is...
why is that amazing? That's common currency.
Right, that's common currency.
Discussion in Israel
but
now.
That's after the occupation ends. You have to understand.
By 2/3 of the Israeli population in a poll about a year ago.
Yeah, you know, we won't have an occupation, but we'll expel, final solution logic, 20% of our population. So can the occupation be the problem? No, obviously it's the logic of the Zionist state,
Joel,
and what that portends. One last thing, and I know this is you know, we talk about the Israel lobbies. Very nice, important, but only one part of it, the situation. You know, yes, the Israel lobbies serve to keep Congress and the U.S. state apparatus in line, and that's a tremendous piece of work. But as you pointed out, there are these foundations. I mean, the Ford Foundation, I think it was back in 2001. I'm trying to remember the exact instance that they gave a certain amount of support for a group that went to the Durban Conference on Racism. Right. And they caught such hell.
Put it mildly. It caused Ford to pull back tremendous funding from various organizations and caused them to have a policy now. Yeah. When you get a grant from Ford, you have to say you will not advocate the destruction of any state. For example, would your argument that you need a one-state solution, would that be advocating the destruction of Israel?
There's a certification that they have to have all their clients sign. Right. If you're, say, a legal support group, you have to check and see the political beliefs of the client and his or her whole family in order to get funding from Ford at this point.
So we have to look at it as a total institution that penetrates all aspects of our society. Not that it can't be dealt with, but it has to be dealt with at the level at which it exists.
And let me point out that that's also happening with the Palestinian NGOs who are worried about their funding, that their activities are limited by their desire to keep functioning.
Joel, Audrey, what's your take on the
tactic for the United States movement to boycott and divest from Israel?
I think it's essential. I think it's one thing that will get under their skin. They have to feel loved in some way. I know that sounds a little hard and sentimental, but it matters to them.
You and Eric Fromm.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, I'm one of those old shrinks.
That's true. I forgot that.
Yeah, yeah.
You haven't beaten it all out of you yet.
Well, yeah. But no,
Jay also believed that love was
not love, but to feel loved.
Okay.
They don't have to.
Right.
They don't have to
feel love for others.
They don't feel love for anybody, but they have to feel accepted. Although they also, it's complicated because they also go it alone. You know, they say we're the people apart. We have different set of
laws. Everyone else is anti-Semitic.
We're the exceptionalists and so on. But it's a delicate matter. In the book I wrote, there's a very important part on the question of the conscience, the bad conscience of Israel, and that I think explains in some degree why they're so awful to the Palestinians, because it's a constant pin pricking at the need for their feeling morally exalted. They have to feel ethically superior. You know, there's this terrible thing that after the Madoff scam collapsed the earth, there was this meeting at Yeshiva University. And
he was the treasurer of the board.
Yeah, it took a huge hit, needless to say. But the point was, how could this happen that Jews would be involved in something so unethical when we know that the Jewish people, are, by definition, this is the cornerstone of our being, is to be ethical in all respects. And you sit there and say, yeah, but what are you doing about Israel? What are you doing about this ongoing human rights violation? Why are you supporting this terrorist state? How does that that conflict with their ethical, pretensions is extraordinarily important? It's what drives their racism, because they have to then say that the Palestinians are subhuman and terrorists. So therefore, it's like a wild animal. It's like Benny Morris even said that there's a wild animal attacking us. We have to put them down. It's not the outside ethics. And so on and so forth. But anyhow, back to boycotts and divestments and sanctions. It is one way that civil society in this country, which is the only thing left, really, when you think of all the institutions that have gone down the Zionist path, that civil society can make a difference by deflating the moral claims. He's saying, yes, Israel, you are a pariah. You have violated the law of humanity, and by what Audrey very cogently pointed out in terms of their systematic violations of all human rights and the all the rules of war and so on. And you cannot be accepted in the human community until you change it. That would make a big difference. I think it's a huge struggle. It's a very tense struggle, because there are some outstanding left-wing and even purportedly anti-Zionist intellectuals in the United States who are completely opposed to the boycotting of Israeli. I mean, there's three levels: boycotting, universities, or divestment as from church, funds. That's a big struggle, and finally sanctions, which of course is at the level of the state and to make Israel fess up and maybe be indicted by the various international courts, as imperfect as they are. I think this is an essential turn of events. It is really where we have to turn if we're going to break the power of the Zionist apparatus in this society.
You've come a long way, Joel, and you, Audrey, and Michael, and I also. But we've come a long way from our origins. Joel, you started off as a Jewish kid from Brooklyn. I started off as a Jewish kid in Chicago. Michael started off in Cleveland. Audrey, you're from New Jersey.
I'm from Brooklyn.
From Brooklyn,
red
initially.
Red diaper baby from Brooklyn.
And here we are, the four of us, condemning the actions of the Zionist government, Israel, to the extent that we're encouraging boycott and divestment and sanction. And my question to both of you, and Joel, I ask you first, and Audrey, you second. How'd you get from where you started out to here? Joel, you were the oldest son. You went to medical school. You were a professor of psychiatry.
Right.
And now you've written Overcoming Zionism. You advocate the one-state solution. There's no longer a Jewish state. And you're calling for these really serious measures against the government of Israel. How did you personally, come to these kind of moral convictions?
There was division in my family, first of all. So I had different sides to. I can see there was different sides to it. And second of all, I always have been of the sort of disposition. Everybody else was for something. I would be questioning that. I just always had the feeling that I should be outside somehow, and I never want to belong to a compact majority. And the reasons for that are complex in turn. But I also think, and by the way, this is very important, I am not at all Jewish in a religious sense. I wouldn't practice a religion. I don't go to seders and things like that because it involves a belief system that I just can't relate to, okay? The exile in Egypt never occurred, as far as I can tell, by the way. It's myth.
It may be accurate.
Yeah.
That is accurate.
Yeah. And so I'm not going to play that game. But I also believe that there is something profoundly Jewish about what I'm doing.
As I said, I was a red diaper baby, so I was not only brought up outside of the Jewish religion, but really with not much Jewish identity. My father, towards the end, after 20 years, became a Zionist. And I guess my awakening to what was going on took place when I graduated high school, and the only place that he would pay for me to travel to was Israel. So I ended up working on a socialist kibbutz on the Lebanese border, Kibbutz Sasa, which was made up of what I thought of wonderful people. I mean, we celebrated the Cuban Revolution on July 26th.
That's great.
However, I used to play ping pong and with some boys who had come up from an Arab village who were arrested when they were coming up one day because they didn't have passes. This was not during the occupation of 67. It was in 65 when the Galilee was still under Israeli military occupation. And that was, a real awakening. The people in the socialist kibbutz didn't come out and back these people. The arrestees, the kids were eventually let go. But, then I realized it was a whole pass system that existed for Palestinians in Israel. Turns out, when I read Ilan Pape's book, that Kibbutz Sasa was built on the ruins of a Palestinian village where there was a massacre. And I can't believe that in 1965 these people didn't know about it.
Oh, sure they did. Sure.
Well, I'll give you the statistic. In the war in 1948 that established Israel, of the 475 Palestinian villages, the Israelis wiped out 385 of them. It's like what you said about power, Joel. If you have power, you can determine your own history. Those villages are no longer on the map. That's why they bombed the university in Gaza. That's why they bombed the library. That's why they destroyed all the public records in Jenin. They're wiping these people out, even their birth certificates.
You worked for various human rights organizations in Palestine, Israel. And then you said you were really allowed to do your work relatively freely, whatever that term means. But that as soon as you got on a boat and went to Gaza, it was an entire different story about how the Israeli government treated you. And there's some lessons, at least from that one anecdotal experience, that I'd like to share with us.
My analysis of the situation is that when I started working for the NGOs there, and I was doing human rights, legal human rights work, I was under the impression that if you document abuse, human rights abuse, then the truth will eventually get out. And when that happens, things will change. But it didn't happen like that. And it's not because of the dearth of documentation. I mean, to take the specific example of Israel and Palestine, Palestinian NGOs, international NGOs, and even Israeli NGOs have been documenting human rights abuse for decades. Not much has changed. And what's missing is not knowledge of what's going on, but political will to deal with it, at least on the part of the governments. People may not know, which is why I think that direct action makes a difference. A handful of people, who, when they were organizing the first trip, I thought they were crazy, going to challenge the might of the Israeli Navy in these small fishing boats going over. They made a change. I mean, they put catastrophic humanitarian and human rights situation in Gaza on the map. Everybody was talking about it. The UN, Richard, was forced to deal with it. Israel was forced to deal with it. The Abbas government in the West Bank was forced. Libya sent a boat in response. So here you had a handful of people who were willing to put their lives on the line. You know, they really were. Mm. It was extremely effective. And I think Israel realized that. They just don't know what to do with it. So that when I participated on the second boat, when I got back, actually the first time I got back, nothing happened. They probably took them a while to realize what had happened. I went to Egypt, and on the way back, all of a sudden they said, I'm violating the conditions of my stay in Israel. After I asked to speak to my lawyer, they were ones that first either put me directly on the plane back to New York or back to Cairo, and I had a ticket to leave from Israel just 3 weeks later. I said that's ridiculous. If I was a threat, you wouldn't have let me stay here for 7 years. What all of a sudden made me a threat? I want to speak to my lawyer. I want to challenge it. I want to speak to the representative of the U.S. consulate. I was in detention for 4 days. I was They physically tried to drag me onto the plane back to Cairo, and I spoke to the Egyptian crew, and they refused to take me. I was taken back down, put into solitary for 2 days for demanding to speak to my consulate, the representative from the U.S. consulate. So a result of that is I was eventually released on 20,000 shekel bond, which is like about $5,000, to ensure that I left the country. But then I filed a complaint with the U.S. consulate, because not only were my rights violated, but this is another example of Israel getting away with outrages. They violated the consulate's right to know that I was there and to be in touch with their nationals.
Right. There's actually a Vienna Convention that requires
exactly.
you to...
How did the U.S. consulate handle this?
First of all, they never came down there while I was there. I don't think they were really contacted, or they said they weren't until four days
right.
later. When I talked to them, they said yes, they were aware of what I called them on. And why don't I just fax them the complaint? I said no, you know, I want to come down there and talk to you, and I want you to file a complaint on my behalf and on your behalf. And they said they would, and I have the name of somebody, but. When I said that I didn't want just to speak to them on the phone while I was in detention, at the end I wanted them to come there and visit me and see what the conditions that I was being held in. I was in solitary. I was in like a small, dirty, stinking room with no facility, not even toilet paper. And they had no idea that there was a place like this.
Audrey and Joel, you really exemplify really what's best in the tradition of justice and humanity and sympathy and compassion. And it takes courage, and you two sure have it. Joe risked his job. Audrey, you're no longer where you were working. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Anytime.
Thanks.
We're also joined by Zahir John Muhammad, who's an attorney with Amnesty International and the advocacy director for Amnesty for the Middle East and North Africa. Zahir has posted on the Amnesty International site, Gaza by the Numbers, where he's documented the tremendous humanitarian catastrophe that the Israeli blockade has caused for the residents of Gaza. Zahir, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Zahir, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Zahir, we're doing a one-hour special, really, on the recent Israeli bombing and possible incursion into Gaza, and we wanted to get your take on it. First, what's actually going on? What's the role of the United States in this? And then we'll keep going from there.
Sure, absolutely. To look at the scale of the current crisis, if you look at some of the comments that were made before the actual bombings occurred, Richard Falk, Human Rights Rapporteur to the United Nations, called Israeli actions a crime against humanity before these bombings had happened. Amnesty International called it a humanitarian implosion in a report we co-authored with Oxfam and CARE in March of 2008.
This is already what you're saying. This is about what was happening in Gaza and the Israeli essentially closing off of Gaza?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the number of trucks that were humanitarian trucks that were going to give supplies before the blockade when Hamas won, it was about 350. In December, by December 5th, The Guardian reported that the number had dropped down to under 10. So now this is all before the bombing happened. So we're talking about a population that had been beaten down, poverty levels reaching 80%, unemployment 40%, factories down to 195 from 3,500 in 2005. So this is a population that had been severely, severely devastated.
Was malnourishment an issue also during this period?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at some of the pictures of those who have been wounded or killed in these attacks, I mean, you can see the rib cage. I mean, look at the prices of food. Palestinian families in Gaza spent 37% of their income on food in 2004. Households in 2007, now granted 2008 was a very brutal year, but 2007, where the last figures are reported, households spent 62% on food. Prices of flour, or wheat, excuse me, rose 34% in a period of 2 months alone in 2008.
So let me ask you, because this is interesting for me to hear. You know, everybody, and we talked to all our friends, were really shocked by the bombings, of course, by the almost probably 400 killed by the time we finish this conversation. But really what you're saying to us is there was essentially a humanitarian catastrophe that at least much of the world wasn't paying this kind of attention to for a period of time.
I would even go even further. When we talk about the Israeli assault on Gaza, people talk, okay, it started on December 27th. In my mind, yes, there was an escalation of strikes starting on the 27th of December. But in my mind, the assault on Gaza has been going on for all of 2008 and 2007. I mean, you look at the numbers, it's absolutely staggering. Hospitals don't have electricity. There's students dropping out of school because they don't have textbooks. They don't even have electricity in the classrooms.
The statistics are 1.4 million in about 140 square miles. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Now, you're really bringing an important perspective here because, you know, it's not like this just happened December 27th. I think that's crucial for people to understand.
Yeah, and in many ways, I think the most appropriate analogy to talk about Gaza is as a prison. Because if you think about it, Gazans eat, they move, they work based on factors outside of their control. Let's look at another statistic. September 2000, there were 24,000 Gazans who crossed into Israel to work in low-labor jobs. And this is all in a report that Amnesty published in 2008, March 2008, with Oxfam and CARE and several other organizations.
Where can you get that report?
You can get it on our website. We have a blog. It's blog.amnestyusa.org. And I put up a post called Gaza by the Numbers where I have all these statistics. So that's 24,000 Gazans crossing into Israel for very important jobs. I mean, granted, they had problems at these border crossings, but they were able to go into Israel for these jobs. Now, that's zero. They are not permitted to enter into Israel for these jobs. Unemployment has reached 40%. I mean, look at the number of factories. So there has been basically an economic strangulation of the Palestinians in Gaza. It's a prison. It's not any sovereign piece of land. So when this notion that this is a punishment on Hamas is absolutely absurd, because you've got the whole population as being subjected to collective punishment. Now, again, the words collective punishment has been used by international bodies and organizations before the 27th of December, before these strikes occurred. So now you add this population that has been so decimated to be subjected to this bombing campaign. It's honestly beyond my comprehension. I mean, many Palestinians have said, we don't have words to describe this. And honestly, I'm at a loss to describe how to even characterize what's happening. It's beyond what I can even imagine.
Zahir, what do you say to the apologists for Israel who say, we are attacking Hamas because by putting pressure on the civilian population, they won't support this terrorist government?
You know, as a human rights organization, we have an obligation to condemn attacks on civilians, regardless of who those civilians are. And we have condemned the rocket fires that have killed so far four Israeli civilians. We've condemned that. But Israeli apologists sort of say that this is an attack directly on Hamas. Again, we're talking about a very dense population, and it is, in my mind, impossible to have a precision attack because international law stipulates that these attacks must be done so that civilian targets are severely, severely avoided. And I do not think that is possible in Gaza. That's one. Secondly, it's a population that has already been decimated. This idea that Hamas broke the ceasefire and then all of a sudden Israel responded, I completely disagree with that because in many ways what's happened is that Israel failed on its end of the bargain. I mean, there was a shipment from Libya in December with 3,000 tons of supplies that was blocked. There were many other assaults by Israel in the year 2008 onto Gaza. I mean, look at the number of Israeli civilians that have been killed by rocket fire. It's 11 for 2008, just 11. I mean, that's the number of people that have been killed in a matter of seconds in these attacks. So I don't think that line holds any credibility whatsoever, and it's really disparaging to hear these comments by Foreign Minister Livni and others saying that we're going to continue this attack. I mean, Gazans have really suffered enough prior to the 27th, let alone what we see in the last 5 days.
Well, why then do you think that Israel is doing this?
Well, I think I think what's really scary, and we saw this in 2006, is that Israel has sort of carte blanche by the international community and by the U.S., which is supplying weapons, to basically do what it wants. And I think what we see from the Israeli government is that if you test us, we'll engage in collective punishment because that's in their right. So the idea of how Israel has often unfortunately defended itself, in my mind, it's to the detriment of Israel itself, is the idea that you attack even one or two of our military personnel and we'll hold the entire population accountable. We saw that in Lebanon in 2006, and we're seeing that in Gaza as well. And what's so disturbing, I say this as an American, is that we're giving weapons. I mean, we have been given these bunker buster bombs. The Jerusalem Report had a good article about that. Just in September, Congress approved 1,000 units of these. They're very small. They're about 1.7 meters so that Israeli airplanes can install more of them onto their planes. And they've been used. I mean, they were used in the to bomb Rafah just very recently in the last few days. I mean, this is all
Rafah is the refugee camp?
Yeah, absolutely. And has been done in the last few days. These are U.S. manufactured weapons. And U.S. law stipulates that U.S. weapons should not be used to commit attacks on civilians. But, of course, no one in the U.S. is even enforcing this because we're basically there is no U.S. policy on Israel. Our U.S. policy is what Israel wants to do, it can do.
You're saying they have impunity, essentially, to do whatever they want.
Absolutely. That has been a policy for a long time.
Yeah, I think it's more than neutral. I think it's a facilitating policy. You point out they paid for the bunker buster bombs. They also gave them the airplanes and they gave them the fuel to fly them. What is Amnesty International advocating in terms of trying to help the Palestinians?
Well, right now we're working on writing a strong course letter action to Condoleezza Rice, urging our members. We have about 500,000 members in the U.S. and about 2 million around the world, writing to Condoleezza Rice to take a strong position on Israel. First of all, condemning the State Department's response to what has happened, because the State Department's response has basically been like, look, you know, yes, it's sad that civilians have been killed, but this is Hamas's fault. We're saying, look, this is not the time to sort of blame Hamas. This is the time to sort of, you know, condemn these Israeli strikes and to urge that there should be a cessation of violence. Gaza has seen enough, and it cannot stand and bear. I mean, there was a great quote from a doctor in the New York Times from one of the hospitals in Gaza who said, I'm hoping if people arrive wounded, we don't have anything that we can do for them because they don't have basic supplies. So our action is basically to Condoleezza Rice and saying the violence must stop, that the Israeli government must be held accountable, and that U.S. weapons should not be used to attack civilians. As a taxpayer, I don't want my money buying these weapons and then these weapons being sent over there to attack civilians.
Zahir Jean Mohammed from Amnesty International, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.